Our reading today is from Matthew. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how can its saltness be restored? It is no longer good for anything, but it is thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hidden. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel basket, but on the lampstand, and gives it light to all the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to the Father in heaven. The word of God for the people of God.
Thank you. Well, we welcome those who are joining us by internet. Wherever you are watching right now, we're glad that you're a part of us like one congregation, spread out all over the place. We hope you feel like you're sitting right here in the room with the rest of us at St. Luke's. Well, kids are going back to school. How many of you have already started school? All right, how many are going this week? This is your first week coming up. All right, so after this week, the majority of youth and kids in this area will be back in school, and we're going to do the same here at St. Luke's. We're starting today a new sermon series called Back to School. So I know it's a bummer, guys, to have to go to school Monday through Friday, but then to come to church and go back to school, that's really tough, isn't it? But I hope this will be fun. We're not going to give you homework, and we're not going to have a final exam, at least not immediately. There won't be a final on this exam. But we're going to study the parables of Jesus. One of Jesus' main ministries was teaching. Rabbis taught in Jesus' day. And one of the things people observed about Jesus is that he did not teach like other rabbis. There was something special about his teaching. He used a unique teaching method, stories. But not just any type of story, what we call a parable. A parable is a story, but a story with profound meaning. Sometimes we don't always get the meaning. Parables are meant to leave us walking away, pondering, thinking about what are all of the truths and the lessons in that story, and what does that have to do with my life? So that's what we're going to look at over these next few weeks. And we begin today with a parable that is all about our purpose and meaning in life. Jesus used two simple images, salt and light. Let me talk first about light. He said, "You are the light of the world." But then he said something that seems perplexing. He says, "People do not light a lamp and put it under a bushel," or as some translations say, under a bowl. The type of lamp Jesus was talking about, which people would have understood, would have looked something like this. This is a replica of a first century oil lamp. Has a little handle, the top a hole where you put the oil, and then the wick would come out here. So in a home, you would have a lamp a little larger than this, and you would light it at night and put it on a tall lampstand so that you could get maximum benefit from the lamp. And here's how you would put it out. You don't just blow out an oil lamp, because when you blow it out, the smoke just continues to rise from it. So you take a bowl and you cover it. That's how you would put out the lamp. You would cover the bowl so the smoke doesn't just continue to come into the room. So Jesus says, a person wouldn't light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Well, why would he even use that analogy? Why light the lamp if you put it under a bowl? And that's the point. Nobody would do that. You light a lamp to give light. The purpose of a lamp is to give light. It makes no sense, doesn't it, to light a lamp and then not utilize it. The purpose of a lamp is to help folks in darkness. Then he said, "You are the salt of the earth." And you can't really see this, but I've got some table salt here in a bowl, just to help us think about salt and what Jesus would have meant when he said, "We are the salt of the earth." Salt was a very important commodity in Jesus' day. It's very valuable. What is salt made of? Chemistry class, what are the two elements in salt? Sodium and chloride. Sodium and chloride. Now, let's see how smart your parents are, okay? In the periodic table of elements, What are the symbols of sodium and chloride? Sodium, Na. I heard Na. Chloride, Cl. NaCl, sodium chloride. Those two elements are brought together to form salt. God created that. God brings them together and makes salt. One of the things I remember from my high school chemistry class is the day our teacher talked about all of the chemicals in the human body. He said that we are 65% oxygen, we're 18% carbon, 10% hydrogen, and on and on and on he went. He said if you had a way to break down all of the chemicals in the average human body and you sold those chemicals individually for what they're worth, what would we be worth? Now let's do a little test here. How many would say under $10? How many would say more than $100? How many would say more than $1,000? How many would say that those chemicals in our bodies would be worth more than $1,000? Okay, couple takers. More than $100. Less than $10. You don't think too highly of yourselves, do you? But you would be correct. Just a little over $5. That's what our human bodies are worth on average. Now, the bigger the body, the more the value. Makes sense, doesn't it? I guess this is a one time you could say it pays to be worth less. It pays to be worth less, you know? You don't want to be that valuable. So the individual elements of the body, about $5. But we know that a human life is worth more than that. A human life is priceless. Why? Because God combines those elements and creates a miracle, the miracle of life, the miracle of these bodies of ours. These bodies that have minds and can think with spirits and souls that can do great, amazing things, that can have purpose and meaning. We're not just the combination of a variety of elements. We're powerful combinations of God's Spirit. We're valuable. When Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth, he is saying you are valuable just like salt was in Jesus' day. Salt was a precious commodity. It was a preservative. They had no refrigerators then. Salt was used to cure meat, to preserve it. That was the one way people had to keep food over a long period of time. It made salt valuable so that it was even used as a form of currency. Roman soldiers were sometimes paid in salt. It is the root of our word salary. Our word salary comes from salt. So the expression worth your salt, it means you're worth what you get paid. You're compensated. You live up to that compensation. You're worth your salt. Jesus says you are the salt of the earth. You are valuable in the same way that salt is valuable, because salt does not exist for itself. Salt exists for other things. Salt serves a purpose for other stuff, not for itself. In fact, too much salt in one place serves no good purpose at all. Some years ago, we made homemade ice cream. And when it came time to clean up, Susan said, now throw the water outside somewhere. That's the water where you have the ice and the rock salt so that you can chill the contents for the ice cream. So by that time, all of the ice had melted, of course, and the salt dissolved pretty much in it except for residue on the bottom. So I take the bucket outside, it's dark. I get to the edge of patio, and I think, oh, this looks fine. I dump it out right there. Yeah, you know where that's going, don't you? Next day, Susan is standing at the edge of the patio over her dead flowers and asks for an explanation. Did you throw the water out here? And I say, you know, I'm guessing that that is not the right answer, that I would have put it there. Killed her flowers. Why? Too much salt in one place does no good. It exists for others. That is why salt has value. So what might Jesus be saying to you and me when he says you are the salt of the earth, salt and light? It's a good metaphor for what we've been doing in our visioning process here at St. Luke's. For the last 18 months now, we have had a team working on our future direction, and you could say that sort of the guiding line of our work has been to consider what does it mean for us to continue being salt and light as a community of faith in the future. Back in February, I shared a progress report in a message one morning on where we were at that point in our work. Let me review a few of those things with you right now. In that message back in February, I identified what we said are the five key directions, things that we said we must emphasize in the next 5 years in our church's future: reaching greater numbers of young people, helping people grow in their faith, developing an outreach and missions emphasis, involving greater numbers of people in service and church leadership, improving facilities, resources, and technology. Following that, we identified goals in each of these areas. We said, we'll help achieve this. We believe God is calling us to do these things to carry out these five emphases. Those got turned into 10 task teams involving about 70 different people in our church. Right now, I'm going to ask folks who are serving on any of those 10 teams, would you come up and stand here in the top step of the chancel? All of those serving on those task teams, if you would make your way up right now. And I'm inviting these people up this morning so that you can see all of the people who've been a part of shaping the strategies for achieving future goals. These goals were not made in a corner by just a few people. All of these folks have had a hand in it. Now, I'm not going to ask them to speak, so don't worry. But I did want you to see them. And in fact, I'm just going to ask folks, if you would, raise your hand when I name the team that you're a part of. One of the task teams, the worship service team for starting a new non-traditional worship service. These are the folks who are part of that group. The children's team working to double attendance in our children's ministry. Our youth team working to double attendance in our youth ministry. Hospitality team working to develop ways we welcome people and help folks find opportunities to get better connected in the life of the church. Growth and faith team working to develop a discipling process for intentional faith development. Marketing team to look at how we can improve communication in our church as well as our community. Outreach team to develop a strategy for determining priorities and engaging every member in missions. Leadership team to create a process for identifying and developing leaders in the church, and I'm a part of that one. Facilities and technology team to look at immediate and long-range building needs as well as the technology that will support ministry for the future. And last but not least, metrics and timeline team to oversee integration and progress of these teams. So I'm going to ask these folks now to be seated. Would you please extend your appreciation? A lot of hard work. These folks have worked tireless hours in some of these areas, developing goals, working on strategies to meet these goals, and I do not have opportunity now to tell you in depth about what is going on in each of these. In October, I'll be giving a more thorough report on our visioning process, but here's what I want to do today. I want to talk about the two that have created great interest throughout our community. Two of these teams that, as word has gotten around and some of the things that we're considering, I know that has raised a lot of interest for folks. So I want to talk about just two of these this morning, and here's what I want to do. I want to tell you what we know at this point. I want to be very clear about what we know we are planning or going to do. Then I want to be certain with you about what is not going to happen, what we are not planning, and then I want to be very clear about what we don't know yet. That sounds like a politician, doesn't it? I want to be clear about what we don't know. So the first one is our facilities team. A facilities team, as you saw many of those folks a moment ago, have engaged the services of architect Eric Rowland. Eric is a member of St. Luke's, lifelong member. He knows our facilities very well. And Eric has partnered with a longtime friend and colleague, another United Methodist architect in Denver by the name of David Cooper. David is a member of St. Andrew Methodist, where Cindy Bates is one of the pastors, and where Kent was an interim senior pastor last summer. He specializes in church design. They have been gathering information, meeting with a lot of our leaders and staff, making their own observations about our building and property, and now starting to design some options that will improve our facilities and help us to reach our goals. Now, here are some of the things they have heard from people about needs related to our building. The need for better lighting. They say we're hearing that a lot. The need for brighter spaces throughout our church. More centralized gathering space that will work well for large numbers of people, that will allow us to accommodate the kind of event that we put on last Sunday with the extravaganza. An easier to navigate design of our building. Easier way to find the entrance points and how to get around the interior of our building, something that they have heard from people. Better lighting for safety at night. And looking at all of our property around us outside the parking lot. Ways to improve traffic flow and maximize our space. Now, this work is in the infancy stage, but let me tell you, I like the baby pictures that I have seen. They're considering some very creative things in regard to our facilities, and in the future, we'll be looking at appropriate time to share this with large numbers of people, with the whole congregation, to get further input and feedback. Now, the second area I would like to talk about is the creation of a new non-traditional worship service. Here is what I can say for certain we are doing or have done up to this point. We plan to launch a non-traditional worship service on Sunday morning. We hope that we'll be able to start this next spring. To do this service, our task team said we're going to need a staff member who will be our director of contemporary worship and will serve on the music staff of our church. We have a search team working very hard right now to identify leads for potential candidates. Now, when it comes to describing exactly what kind of music will it have, what will that service look like, that gets rather difficult because it will be a variety of things. It will not look like our current service. It will have a variety of instruments. Many will probably be electric instruments. The music will probably sound somewhat similar to what we've heard this morning. It'll look like many other contemporary services in churches, but it won't be edgy. We're not going to hand people earplugs when they come in the door. And there are churches that do that. There are some, it will not be like that. It'll have lots of video. It will be Christ-centered. It will be casual. Sometimes we will sing hymns. There will be drama, other use of the arts. It will be done with excellence. Now, here is what will not happen. Traditional worship is not going away at St. Luke's. I thought that might get a Yahoo or something out of some. When people hear the description of a contemporary service like I just shared, or they think of places where they've been with contemporary worship, they say, that is not for me. And they're looking for the Pepto-Bismol or the antacids, you know, to calm down the stomach. And I say, that is the very reason that we're going to continue to have traditional worship done with excellence at St. Luke's. St. Lukers are not going to be forced to choose another style of worship. Now, here's what we don't know. We don't know what time or where this service will be. We've had many meetings with more to come to evaluate the best time for this service, to maximize the opportunity to reach new people, to fit well with all of our existing activity on Sunday morning. But we don't have clarity about that just yet. We are going to be looking at just the right fit for all that goes on with Sunday morning activity, and like I say, to reach new people. Now, I have heard some people say, I'm offended when we talk about targeting younger people because it leaves out those who are already here. Now, my answer to that doesn't have a lot of finesse to it, is that's just a myth. That is just a myth. To reach new people does not mean we have to ignore those who are already here. And if reaching new people meant anybody had to be ignored, I do not believe that would honor God. I do not believe that would honor God. So we're not going to be ignoring any. We're not going to be leaving anybody out. In fact, just the opposite right now. We have started what we're calling Operation Contact. And I'm just so pleased with the way staff leaders have taken on this challenge of, in the coming months, calling every household in St. Luke's, and I don't even know how many that is, thousands, to let people know, we care about you, how are you doing, how can we pray for you, is there other support you need? We're going to make sure every St. Luke's person knows that. Because what good does it do to reach more and more people if the ones who come in the door do not find love and care and faith development and help and opportunity? If we only care about you when you visit early on, there's not integrity in that. So we're going to really focus on letting people know that we do indeed care. Now, while it would be a travesty to ignore people who are here, I believe it would be an equal travesty to ignore people who are not here. To just say, well, we exist for us. That's our target audience. That's our market. The people who keep our church financed. The ones who built it and made it what it is. That's who we need to keep happy. Folks, I'm sorry, that would be a travesty. Why? Because we're called to be salt and light. We are as valuable as we give ourselves away for other people. That's what brings purpose and meaning to community. If we are salt that just exists for salt, then all we're going to do is assault one another. And there are enough churches assaulting each other, aren't there? There are many people who say, that's the very reason I could care less about Christianity and churches. Because all I do is hear them point fingers and say, well, we don't want those people in our church. We can't agree over this issue. They're just fighting. Folks say, I don't have time for that. But a church like St. Luke's, I believe our world is in desperate need of. A church that says we're open. We're not pointing fingers at anybody. We're not telling people they're not accepted. We want everybody to know they're accepted. But it might mean that we've got to look at new ways to help people get that message. We're an open community. We'll continue to be open to exploring ways that will help those who are all around us know and hear and experience that good news. Now, why would we do this? Before you start writing your notes to me about what you hope does not change and what you hope we keep the same and don't do this here. I mean, before you do that, let me remind us why. Why would we do it? A few years ago, Susan and I went to a conference in Chicago, and the conference was well outside of the city. And one day we had a free day, so we took the train into downtown Chicago to sightsee. And we did a lot of walking around. At the end of the day, we were exhausted, but we had about a 45-minute train ride to get back to our hotel. So we got on the train, and it was just packed with people, you know, going home from work. It was just that wrong time of day, crammed. And you learn pretty quick the culture of the train. The culture of the train is everybody out for him or herself. That's how it works. You want a seat, you better be quick. So I'm tired, my feet are hurting, I'm holding a bar because there's no place to sit, and we're coming up on a stop, and I see a couple a little distance down starting to gather their stuff. I take Susan's hand, and we squirm through the humanity. So I am standing there. The moment they start, like, halfway out of the seat, I am down in it, you know, just making sure I get my spot. And then I'm looking around at the other losers who didn't pay attention. And I'm like, you know, good job. I look at Susan. Aren't you proud to have a man like me in your life? Get you a seat. So next stop, that couple gets off and an elderly woman gets on, heavy bag over her shoulder, and she's got like this mini walker. And she gets on the train, and here's my thinking. I bet that walker comes in handy to hold your balance when you have to stand on the train. And that's sad, isn't it? Sad, but I'm thinking, I bet that thing, she probably didn't even need to reach up and grab, she couldn't even reach it anyway, so she's got that walker. That'll help her. And while I'm thinking this, the man across from me reaches out, grabs her arm and says, "Ma'am, would you please take my seat?" And he gets up and she gladly takes it. And I think, show off. And then I think, you know, why didn't I do that? You know, why didn't I beat him to that? Why didn't I act as quick on that as I did getting the seat? And I just started pondering that. I thought, you know, that's really who I am. I mean, that's my true nature. My true nature is to spot other people. Oh, that person needs something. Let me help. What happened here? And I realized I got caught up in the culture around me. The culture of the train eroded my nature. It took away my value, my saltiness. And I got to thinking about church. And I thought, you know, the church really is called to be countercultural. I mean, we're called to be a very different kind of community that says, well, we're not here for ourselves. We don't do all of this for us. We do it to give ourselves away, to help extend the message of good news and hope that we've already got down to other people who might not have it down just yet. That's why we do it. And when people experience that kind of counterculture, I mean, you can't keep them away. It just becomes a question of making room for them. That's why we do it. That's why we're considering these things, to make room for others. We're going to sing a closing hymn that you probably don't know, and I don't mean to evaluate your hymnody there, but it's not in our current hymnal. It did not make it from our previous hymnal into the one we use now. Charles is going to play it so you can listen as I tell you the story about this hymn, and then we'll sing it in a moment. It's called "Brightly Beams Our Father's Mercy." The refrain goes like this: "Let the lower lights be burning, send a gleam across the wave. Some poor fainting, struggling sailor, you may rescue, you may save." Some of you, you remember from back in the day. It probably didn't make it into the current hymnal just because that language got unusual to us, perhaps. People said, what is that talking about? I'm not a sailor. I'm not out trying to rescue people. That just seems odd. Mark Trotter, former pastor of First Methodist San Diego, said he used to make fun of that hymn all the time. Said it sounded old-fashioned, and sometimes when he was at a party with his friends, he and his friend would sing that song, but they'd really ham it up. They'd make it sound sort of southern and gospely. They would mock a southern accent. "Let the lower lights be burning." They'd hold their finger to their nose, you know. He said he did that until one day he read the story behind the hymn. A guy named Philip Bliss wrote it, a musician. He was in Chicago, and he attended a service where Dwight Moody preached. And Dwight Moody told the story about a ship that not too long before had been trying to find safe harbor in Cleveland. It was stormy, the water was rough, and the captain saw the lighthouse. So he got close enough where he could yell out to the keeper of the lighthouse, "Is this Cleveland Harbor?" And he heard the voice shout back in the darkness, "Yes, it is." The captain, "Where are the lower lights?" The keeper, "They are out. Can you manage the harbor safely?" And the captain said, "I have to try." So he passes the lighthouse, but he can't find the channel. And the waves smashed the boat against the rocks, and many people were killed. And Dwight Moody said, "Friends in the church, The keeper of the lighthouse is our Father above. He will shine his light. We are called to be the lower lights along the shoreline that make sure people find their way into the harbor. That's our job. So he wrote this hymn. You know, last Sunday, a woman stood here and shared how a year ago she was trying to find harbor and she was about to give up. And she reached out to her church, St. Luke, she's a member, and said, this is my situation, I need help. And we gave her some things. One of them was a gift certificate to a restaurant, $250. I had no idea until just a few weeks ago that she and her daughter lived on that gift certificate for several months. And she said, that's the only way we survived. And then she stood here last week to say, now my life is in a different place. And it's my joy to give $250 to the extravaganza to other kids. She now is a lower light. She found hope. Now she gives hope. How many more people, by the things we're talking about doing for the future of St. Luke's, will bring greater numbers of lower lights into our community? People who will find hope for themselves, be a part of that giving hope to others. So let's join together singing our closing hymn, Brightly Beams Our Father's Mercy.